very much. Thank you very much for that introduction, and thanks for inviting me to come and speak to you. I'm going to begin with a sort of a preamble. So most of my talk will be sort of very much connected to the book which was just mentioned, kindly advertised for me there. I would like to begin with, though, something a little bit more personal, just to give you some of the background on my own sort of journey here, if you like. So I've been willing to call myself one who would, you know, be happy to accept the label of Christian for however long it is, since I was about 19 or 20, right? That's, what is that? That's coming on 30 years. And my experience of that has been, mostly positive, but a mix, sometimes painful. You know, so it's, you know, there's a lot of positive things there, some difficult things. The positive things have mostly been the mutual support which one gets from a group of, you know, people who include among them, you know, people reasonably wise and helpful, and sort of all of them good-hearted at least, and many among them very wise. So that's the, you know, the most positive thing in my experience. The painful thing I want now to just share with you, partly in order that I might, if possible, relieve some of you from having the same sort of pain that I have had to some extent. I mean, I won't be able to keep you free of all trouble and care, but maybe in one area I can make the journey a little smoother. So the painful thing I'm talking about is the sort of the intellectual wrestling which goes on for anyone who has, by God's grace, that area of their life sort of deeply important to them. I mean, not everyone is quite so bothered about intellectual questions as I suspect most people in the room here today are. You know, plenty of folks will get on and be worried about other things, and that's great, that's fine for them. But some of us are bothered by intellectual things, and intellectual wrestling is difficult. And part of that difficulty is a creative difficulty, which one shouldn't complain about. You know, it's a sort of learning is growing pains. But there's an aspect to it which I will say I think I've come to realise you can complain about. So I'm going to offer you that aspect and complain about it for a moment, and then I'll move on to the main part of the talk. So I take it that people here are, broadly speaking, pretty positive about the idea of faith. I'm taking it that, you know, if you're here tonight, mostly you'll be positive about that concept. And I'm going to speak, by the way, you see I've got some notes here. I'm going to speak mostly from these notes because it helps me be more efficient in what I say, but I hope it'll come over in a reasonably immediate sense. So we think that faith is to do with responding as fully as we can to one who can and does know us and who is interested in inner transformation and social justice. But if you ask us to say more precisely who it is we're talking about when we say this, we will struggle to put it into words. Now, here's the point. If you think I'm speaking about something you recognise, then listen up. Whether or not you think it is called faith, if this humble, truth-seeking, brave and creative attitude is something you feel you want to buy into, then I would like to say, hooray, there's no shame in what you're doing. I say this because a lot of people want us to feel ashamed. They want us to feel that this deep-seated part of us is shameful and childish. Despite all the efforts that you and I make, week in, week out, to think it through and hold it up to intellectual scrutiny. I'm speaking about this, as I said, because I want, if I can, to reduce the sum of suffering in the world. And I can do this by declaring the truth of the situation accurately. I think it might be a bit like the experience that, in other times and places, ethnic or other minorities have been made to undergo, in which the mud slung at them began to stick right down to their hearts and souls. They began to suspect that perhaps they really were some sort of subclass of human being. And now, for all the confident posturing of the evangelical part of the Christian community, I think that many of us in the Christian movement have begun to suspect that the mud thrown at us is deserved. We have begun to suspect that there is something substandard about us, something intellectually substandard. And we are sinners, aren't we? So we can't object. But I want to say that we can object. Being honest about your failings does not mean accepting insults as truthful. What we try to do with insults is not return them, but we are by no means required to take them in and believe them. In how many lectures this week in this university has the lecturer mentioned or implied that faith in the wellspring we call God might be a good thing? I guess the answer is, outside the training of ordinands, zero. But, so this is more telling, what would result if someone did try to be positive about the wellspring we call God? They would be rapidly silenced. The students would assume it was something called religion showing its head, and religion must not be mentioned. It is a private thing, private and divisive. It is not part of education. It is not even part of the language of adults. It is the perverse make-believe of some intellectual underclass, a species of second-rate human called believer. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not suggesting that you should be anything but wise and sensible about the way you speak in public. But what I'm trying to do here is give you some breathing space. I want to say that the modern taboo about faith in God is utterly unjust. It holds everyone, except an atheist, under a presumption of guilt in the area of intellectual integrity. And that is deeply unjust. It's the modern equivalent to the rumours in the Roman world that the Christians were practising cannibalism and incest. I make that comparison in order to emphasise how objectionable and unjust I feel this to be. I object strongly to the modern presumption of intellectual guilt, because I hold intellectual integrity to be very important. Our ancestors struggled hard for the principle called the presumption of innocence. The idea that in criminal law, one will be presumed innocent until proven guilty. When modern people serve us up with a presumption of guilt in the area of rationality, they are going against this hard-won principle, and it is no light matter. I do not require you to fight back vocally. Indeed, I would say you must mostly bear it graciously without reacting. But I invite you not to take it into your heart. If your faith has been carefully thought through, as I fully expect it has, then give yourself a break. Enjoy. The badge of intellectual integrity can be yours. And especially, you do not need to be ashamed of your willingness to look to God and learn and respond, because the bedrock reality, the one that you and I really live in, once all the delusions are swept away, will cherish and affirm this tendency in you. And part of the way you learn, and part of the way you respond, is to do science. And so my talk today is about the place of science in the life of faith. I could shorten that phrase. My talk will be about the place of science in life. Because life is a life of faith. It cannot avoid being so. You cannot live without living, and you cannot explore without exploring, and you cannot go somewhere new without setting out for unknown territory. And that is what faith is all about. It takes place in a situation of not knowing for sure, but having a sense of value, a sense of wishing to learn and grow, and to come to know. Let me add immediately that I extend this to faith in full. I extend it to the felt experience and perfectly reasonable opinion that our universe is, and our lives are, the outworking of a wonderful, creative, supportive and rich reality that meets us on every level of our being. However, see what you make of the following. This is a letter I found in New Scientist magazine. I'll just read it out. I was intrigued by your claim that science is not a belief system, 4th April, page 5. Surely what it is not is a faith system. Science is belief based on evidence. Faith, on the other hand, is belief irrespective of evidence. Science gives rise to beliefs that fit the existing evidence, allowing for them to change should new evidence make that sensible. Faith takes beliefs and puts them on an untouchable pedestal where they remain, no matter what contradictory evidence there is. Most of us frequently employ a fairly scientific belief system. Take the simple example of the day of the week. When I woke up this morning, I believed it to be Thursday based on the evidence of my memory. Had I then looked at my computer and my phone and the newspaper and seen that day given as Friday, I would have changed my belief, trusting the evidence of the computer, phone and newspaper over my memory. However, if I applied a faith-based belief system, I would have refused to take note of the contrary evidence and insisted that the day was Thursday no matter what. It is lack of faith, not lack of belief, that makes science so special and so wonderful. Now, I know that this letter is utterly confused, but what I want to point out is as follows. This is a letter to New Scientist magazine, published a month or so ago, and it was not just any letter that week. It was the editor's pick letter. The editors picked, no less, the best letter. The editor of New Scientist apparently thinks that this is what faith means. What faith means, according to this, is, basically, a sort of bizarre behaviour involving superstition, rejecting the evidence of your senses, and a degree of delusion verging on insanity. Now, I think all of us here feel strongly that what we mean by the word faith is not like that at all. But I included this letter in order to help you see the problem. Our very language is being redefined. Some of our favourite words have been taken and distorted out of all recognition in large communities represented by mainstream magazines such as New Scientist. I think the blame for this lies partly with the Christian Church, partly with other religious groups, and partly with the atheist community. Every time some Christian speaker has spoken nonsense and then attached the word faith to the nonsense, they have diminished the word. And every time some non-religious person has said that faith is about belief without evidence, they have insulted the intelligence of millions of reasonable people, including, I guess, everyone present in this room. So we have a decision to make. Should we keep the word faith and insist on its original meaning, which is close to trust, humility, and creative adventure? Or should we try some other combination of words and translate the Bible afresh? Should we ask our linguists, please, to give us a translation of the Bible that does not use a word that many people now take to mean ill-considered guesswork and superstition? I have thought hard about this. I have thought about 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and that lovely triple jewel of faith, hope, and love. I have thought about the Gospels. My own conclusion is that we should keep the word faith, but show and explain what it means. Now I'd like to share with you a poem. The poem is called Hope. Here is my lovely sign of hope. It will sound impossible, but bear with me. It is everywhere, but you will not find it by looking at any particular place. It is far from you, but also close as you are to yourself. It is not on the map, and you will not find it by digging, nor by sending up balloons to assay the sky. It is nowhere but everywhere, yet in each place you can find the whole of it. All this because it is not a location, but a direction. It is not a place you can claim, but a way to look. You must not hide your shadow behind you, but throw it down before. Then, stay still, focus on infinity, and look in a particular direction. And suddenly there it is, layer on layer, in all its colours, as luminous as if it were refreshed just that instant, replenished again with fullness of arching light breaking out of the water. In certain dry seasons you will see nothing, but by faith and reason working together, you can reconstruct the possibility, which will be real enough if once you have seen it before. If there are any physicists present, I hope you might have noticed the correct use of technical language here. Focusing on infinity is a precise technical term in optics. It is what you have to do in order to see a rainbow. Also, the rainbow optical phenomenon is all about light travelling in a given direction rather than from a given place. This makes it an apt illustration of the concept of omnipresence. It is nowhere but everywhere, yet in each place you can find the whole of it. What the poem is mostly trying to do is to show that something that sounds at first like a sheer impossibility might in fact be perfectly possible once you have realised that it is a different sort of thing than you first thought. In the rainbow example, it turns out that we are not talking about a shiny physical object located at one place. We are talking about the spread of colour as a function of direction of travel. Similarly, when we meet on a Sunday morning or kneel in a quiet spot at home, we are not talking about a super powerful, supernatural superbeing, the chief entity in the class of all entities. We are talking about that which breaks out of the whole category of entities. We are talking about the truth of the reality from whom our lives flow and to whom they return. Of course, by saying from whom and to whom, not from which and to which, I have taken a decisive step into a certain way of looking at things. I think this is truthful. I think this is a sound step, a truth-seeking and a reality-finding step. But I admit it remains a profoundly mysterious step. I think none of us quite knows what we really mean by God. Our words run out. Language itself runs out. Speaking for myself, I would say that what I mean by the word God is whatever Jesus of Nazareth meant by the phrase. Now, I haven't prepared it for you. I've got it written down in Greek, okay? So I've got my Greek New Testament, and I've written out a bunch of Greek symbols, which I'm not able to pronounce correctly. But I know what the common translation into English is. But of course, my point is that Jesus himself originally said it in Aramaic. And the translation process into modern English, you just have to think it through a little bit carefully to ask yourself whether you've got what he meant, what he meant, not what modern day people might assume he meant. Now, the phrase I have in mind is the one commonly translated, your heavenly father, or more literally, father of you who is in the heavens. And my point is that that word heavenly, or in the heavens, has become very greatly skewed in our culture. You know, it no longer means this, it no longer carries the connotation that it carried in Jesus' day and in his culture, of that which you can really rely on. It had in his day the connotation of the absolute bedrock reality. That's who I'm talking about. But of course, now, that same word, heavens, now means, oh, some sort of airy-fairy, non-existent never-neverland. Okay? It just does not mean that. So my point is then that when I say that short word, begins with G, that word so commonly thrown around and misused, you know, the most commonly misused word, if I tried to say what I mean by it in a short phrase, I would say, well, I mean whatever he meant by it. So I should go there first and then go further. Okay, now, you're waiting for me to talk more about science. I'm a scientist, after all, and I promised to talk about science. So I am doing it. I'm just about to get there. But I'm going to get there by first saying a bit more about the word faith, and then the science part will be able to go more sort of fluidly. So if we are going to rescue this beautiful concept of faith, then we need to find our own clarity about what it is. So I'm now going to borrow some material from a talk I gave this year at the Faraday Institute in Cambridge. And you can find this talk on the web, so if you've already seen it, some of this will be repeat. But I have reworked this quite a lot, so don't worry, it's not just the same old thing. So the word faith is, as I've already said, greatly misused when people employ it to talk about ideas that have no motivating evidence, or subjective beliefs with little or no reasonable credentials. So what is it then? Well, faith is not about belief without evidence. Faith is about willingness to rise to the challenge that evidence presents. We exercise a kind of faith, of course, all the time. When I finish a conversation with my friend, I don't fear that they will afterwards tell lies about me to other people. I just don't worry about that. When I walk in the street, I don't fear that the people passing by will suddenly gang up on me. And of course, if I didn't have these assumptions, I wouldn't be able to sort of get by from day to day. But also at a scientific conference, I trust that the speakers have not misrepresented their experimental data, and so on. We all do this all the time. This is a form of faith, and of course we can't live without it. There's faith involved in scientific research more directly, because we have to launch our investigations without knowing at the outset whether they'll prove to be fruitful. And interestingly, in my experience, publishing work also requires a little bit of courage. I never know for sure that I've made no mistake. Every paper I've ever published, I've sent off with a slight bit of trepidation, thinking, goodness, will I be proved to have been a bit stupid in this case? So there is a certain degree of risk and trust involved. The risk that you may be mistaken, the trust that others will give your work a fair appraisal. But we have to be willing to take such risks and trust one another, or we will not, as a community, learn and progress. So this has something of the character of faith. And interestingly, when there are really important new ideas in science, they very often involve a certain amount of willingness to champion the idea, even though there may be unresolved difficulties. The great works of Newton, Darwin, Einstein, Dirac, and many others all involve this kind of faith. Newton had the puzzle of why the cosmos did not collapse if everything attracted everything else by gravitation. Darwin's great work on the origin of species faced many unresolved dilemmas about speciation and the like when he first published it. Einstein's general relativity had almost no experimental evidence to support it for a long time, but it was accepted by the physics community largely because of its mathematical beauty. Dirac's work on relativistic quantum mechanics involved a frankly bizarre physical picture of the cosmos filled with infinitely many negative energy electrons. This was an almost nonsensical idea, and yet the theory proved to be highly insightful. It was only later learned that the nonsensical physical picture was not needed. The equation could be interpreted another way. So all of these people exercised a type of faith. This faith is, I'll just put it here, a willingness to champion a way of looking at things because of its elegance and broad scope, even though there remain puzzling predictions or apparent holes and inconsistencies. So I've given a variety of examples about this word faith now. It's a meaning that's well captured by the phrase, I acted in good faith. It's a positive and good aspect of human life. Now, of course, religious faith is not exactly the same as all these other examples, of course. But the point is, it is something like them. It has an element of that same character, willingness to champion a way of looking at things because of its elegance and broad scope, even though there remain puzzling predictions or apparent holes and inconsistencies. Faith is a well-motivated trust, willingness, eagerness for the journey, engagement based on the beginnings of a sense of recognition. So whether or not you want to use the word faith, that set of ideas is what I'm now talking about when I talk about faith and science in the life of faith. Now, here is how a lot of people think about this. Here is how they think about faith and science. They imagine them as sort of occupying a space each on its own, one on each side, quite different sorts of thing. Of course, I've already given some indicators that the truth is not quite as simple as that. But perhaps some of people here nevertheless sort of have half wondered for quite a long time that possibly is sort of like that. Well, what is it like? It's actually like this. So here's the truth of the situation. Faith is the word we use to talk about the whole way of sort of trying to embrace the whole of our life and try to live it creatively and truthfully. And science and the arts and humanities are, of course, all part of that. For those who have a good version of religious faith, and goodness knows, don't we know it, there's plenty of bad versions of religious faith. I mean, I'm using the word religion occasionally today, but every time, in the back of my mind, a little alarm bell sounds. You know, religion is so awful. But of course there is such a thing as good religion, which has done a vast amount of good, and that's what I mean when I'm talking about religion today. So, for those who have a good version of religious faith, science is not in another compartment, but rather it sits within the overall adventure and willingness to trust. Faith includes, for example, a willingness to trust that our ultimate maker and caller is not out to trick us. It includes the sense that investigating the natural world and understanding its patterns is part of what we're for. Now, this point is stronger than you might think. When you see it on a simple diagram like this, it all seems rather simple, maybe tame, but it's quite powerful. It says that there is not a dialogue between science and religion, because science is already part of religion, the only good type of religion, and that is. The religious people are not all standing at the side looking at science from the margins and trying to keep up. But let's admit it, that's what a lot of the religious people are doing. But no, the religious guys, some of them at least, are the scientists. Let's make sure they are among the best scientists. Science is what we do if we are faithful, when we want to analyse the patterns of the physical world. Dialogue is the wrong way to see the relationship. Science is part of being faithful. It's the part appropriate to certain types of tasks. Now, here's another picture, faith and reason. Do you remember I began with a quietly passionate statement about reason and rationality? But here's a way a lot of people see it. They think that somehow faith and reason are utterly separate and unlike. Faith is not exactly the same as reason, of course, but that does not mean they are alternatives. Rather, they work together. So here's the image that I would like to offer you on that. Faith shapes the questions you ask. Reason helps you ask them. Reason may show you evidence that a bridge is sound. Faith steps onto the bridge. Reason explores a territory based on given assumptions. Faith seeks the best assumptions. And so on. Now, here's another picture. Here's faith connected with rationality and irrationality. So, rational and irrational, I am here regarding as alternatives. So, the idea that a copper bracelet might protect you from rheumatism, though widely believed at one time or another, is irrational. Rational broadly means sequences of arguments, you know, more or less along the Greek model. If the tomb was empty, then either the body was never put there, or something happened to it. There's sort of a sequence of arguments. And then faith embraces that, but it does go further, because it includes those parts of our lives which simply can't be contained merely in that class of things that you can state by very tentative or very sort of moderate and passive assertions and work from them. It includes braver things and commitments, like the question, will you marry me? Which one person might, one time or another, ask another person. And I hold it that that question, while not being fully within the category called rational, is nevertheless not irrational. So, faith is not irrational, and it does not embrace irrationality. It resists all forms of superstition. However, faith does venture beyond reason, because it includes those aspects of our lives that cannot be captured by reason alone. All this seems very positive and hopeful and joyful too. But of course, a lot of people do not see it this way. They note that science can, in principle, address any question whatsoever about the physical world. They infer then that this is all that needs to be said. After all, scientific investigation never involves any appeal to any source of intention or compassionate agency other than the one we encounter in individual human beings and other animals. So doesn't this mean that science is essentially atheistic? This question is part of that painful tension that I mentioned that I have lived with. An intellectual pain is pain. It is difficult to bear. But it can sometimes be relieved by intellectual methods. That is, by the careful application of reason. So such relief is part of what I'm offering today. So first let's spell out the situation, and then we'll see what we make of it. So it is widely felt to be something like the following. So here are some statements. Statement one. There is something characteristically atheistic, or possibly deistic, about science. That is its natural ambiance. Statement two. The fact of the matter is that science has slowly but surely pushed God aside. Science is a sensible and productive way forward to learn about the real world. Where once it seemed that God must be the explanation for things, science has shown that this is not required. We can't be sure that God is real in any case. The most honest and really the most creative attitude is to let all religious ideas simply evaporate and not bother with them. Statement three. Religious ways of thinking involving sacred truths, dogma and authority are stifling to the whole scientific enterprise. And statement four. Science reveals a fully mechanistic description of the world and people in it. This is the straight truth which we must accept. So, I have presented all these assertions just to give a frank and clear presentation of how many people honestly see the situation. Many people either here in the room may suspect it's really like this, or certainly you may have friends who are pretty sure it is like this. So, is this true? Is science atheistic, really, if we're honest? It's taken me quite a long time to get to a place where I feel like I make sense of all this. But here is roughly what I think the truth of the situation is. So, first of all, something characteristically atheistic about science, is this true? Well, here's a thought. I reply, well, no, actually. I've already given examples of the fact that science is not altogether a dry exercise of deriving facts by logic. It's much more adventurous, exploratory, and open-ended than that. But it does include logic, of course, and some of the time we are working our way through abstract calculations. And when you are thinking about patterns of abstract or impersonal phenomena, that is what you are thinking about. When you are doing a calculation, you are not at that moment thinking about whether or how much you love your children, or for a younger audience, your siblings or your parents. But this does not mean that science is naturally opposed to love for children or siblings or parents. Similarly, you're not at that moment of doing an abstract calculation. You're not then thinking about how much or whether you love God. But this does not mean that you are, that what you're doing is at all atheistic. We adopt the tools appropriate to the job in hand. Your love for your children and your love for God is signalled at that moment by the care you bring to the analytical task that is for a while what you're focused on. Being real about God is to do with being fully human, alive and humble, thankful and productive. Science is just as theistic as everything else, if we make it so. The reason that many theists do not mention this in their scientific lectures, books and conferences is perhaps largely an act of courtesy, a respect for diversity, and a wish not to intrude themselves into their work. Now, two, the fact of the matter is that science has slowly but surely pushed God aside. We can and should let all religious ideas simply evaporate and not bother with them. Well, I reply that this statement is simply too sweeping. What science has helped to get rid of is not all religious ideas, but just those that were wrong in ways that science can detect. This is largely about getting rid of superstition. But Christian faith has always opposed superstition. It has thought long and hard about reason and faith, and I think some of you are carrying on that careful thinking today. Religious leaders have mostly patiently resisted the superstitions arising in their congregations. Of course, there have been huge failures too, but the overall record is much stronger than people nowadays are aware. For example, the church largely originated and certainly massively promoted the idea of universal education. I understand it that the origins of literacy for all in the UK lie with a concerted effort by the Anglican Church in an era when the secular state could certainly have taken it on but did not. Indeed, literacy and good governance have both been massively promoted throughout the world by efforts from wise and self-giving religious groups. But my present point is that in helping us to get rid of superstition, science has been a true friend to, and indeed a part of, Christian commitment. And after we've got rid of all the superstitious ideas about God, we are still left with all the best ideas. For example, the idea of grace and the idea of a relationship enacted by mutual recognition. The idea of love as the fundamental principle of the universe rather than a lucky offshoot of mindless processes. Science has not disproved that idea. The idea also of a relationship with the wellspring of authentic life, based on compassionate love for who we really are, and not at all about rewards for doing good. Science has not unpicked this at all. Also, the idea of partnership, of sharing the painful task of reconciliation, bearing pain and confronting the power brokers of the world. These are all ideas that spring up from a true vision of our relationship to the absolute bedrock and compassionate inspirer of our lives, the committed Father that Jesus of Nazareth spoke of and copied. These are good ideas, great ones, and science has not diminished or intruded on them one iota. Rather, it has helped us to live by them and to clear away the superstitious confusions that stood in the way of them. I could go on, but for now I'll leave it there and repeat again that science is part of a life of faith in God, not an alternative to one. Now, religious ways of thinking involving sacred truths, dogma and authority are stifling to the whole scientific enterprise. Well, I hear we can admit that sometimes religion does degenerate into this type of thinking. But the stifling or controlling types of religion described here is not what following Jesus of Nazareth is about. Churches and religious people do sometimes fall into that way of thinking, but they do not need to, and often do not. Furthermore, far from stifling science, the Christian community has largely nurtured science and done it well. And I would like to add, it's not quite true that there are no sacred truths in science, as people sometimes imagine. There is, for example, the sacred truth that ideas should be tested, arguments should be reasonable. I call it sacred truth because it's a sense of something that you just have to buy into in order to even start doing science. And we don't sort of reconsider every year whether or not we should be testing our ideas and trying to make our arguments reasonable. There's the sacred truth that fellow scientists should be treated with fairness and so on and so on. There are plenty of sacred truths. And now the last one. Science reveals a fully mechanistic description of the world and people in it. This is the straight truth which we must accept. Well, this I simply oppose because I think it's simply false. The mechanistic, or also algorithmic or automaton-like description of the physical world is not revealed by science. It is assumed by much of science as a working model. And I admit, it's a very productive working model. But we are far from being able to tell that this sort of automaton model can correctly describe everything that goes on in human bodies when we make decisions and try to be rational and loving. And of course, there are many well-known philosophical issues here. But I would say that the weight of the evidence is against the automaton picture of human life. The weight of the evidence is that we are not automatons, in my opinion. The reductionist model of the universe is highly questionable, and I do question it. So now I will pause a moment. Let's say what I've done so far, and I do still want to cover some material. Now, I think I've got another sort of 10 minutes in my allotted time, Jaguar. Yeah. That'd be fair to say. Okay. So, and as you see, by using a script, there's quite a lot packed in there, right? Your brain's beginning to think, goodness, can I take this in? I'm giving you a little breather now. Think. Okay. So here's what I've said so far, and what I want to cover. So far, I've tried to describe what I think faith is. I've then illustrated ways in which science is itself a rather rich sort of activity, which goes well beyond a mere exercise in logic. I've also, sometimes in what I've said, given little pointers to how I think we can talk about the wonderful, but always beyond our grasp, true parent whom Jesus of Nazareth most clearly showed us. I want to emphasise that science is very much part of what a child of that true parent will do, and what joiners of the way of Christ will share in. This is because science is all about uncovering the wonders of a marvellous created world, and also about providing daily bread, relieving debt, healing people, and helping them in their trials, all things that Jesus of Nazareth was keenly concerned about. So let's celebrate science and do it well. Let's remind ourselves that science is not some sort of add-on to the kingdom or way of community life that Jesus of Nazareth talked about. Rather, it is part of that kingdom and completely at home there, along with schools and hospitals, freedom of speech, democratic political process, and so on. So in the rest of this talk, I will first elaborate on some positives about science, and then I will say a bit about the limits of science. Both are important. First, some positives. To love God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, and all your strength includes, for people with the relevant gifts, carrying out scientific study thoroughly, carefully, and at the highest level. When I looked through the history of physics, that's, of course, the area that I'm sort of part of, I was very struck by the high level of the contribution I found from people whose religious commitments were clearly owned by them and not merely some sort of social convention. Here are some examples. So here are pictures showing Galileo, Newton, James Clerk Maxwell, William Thomson, also called Lord Kelvin, Arthur Eddington, and one could add Faraday, Boyle, and many others. Now, as a physicist, these are all famous names to me. You know, they're sort of heroes of the subject. But the point is, the contribution of these people was really remarkable. These are some of the intellectual giants. I would be interested to know if the record is equally strong in other disciplines. I'm afraid I'm no expert on that. Perhaps someone here present would be able to help us on this. Now, I'd like to add, it is true that people committed to their faith in God are a minority in science, as they are in every other discipline. But their contribution has been great. In the case of physics, it is in fact hard to overstate the net contribution of serious Christian people. The positive contribution of Jewish people to intellectual and cultural life is also out of all proportion to their numbers. So let's encourage the gifted in our generation to do what they can to uphold this great tradition and thus serve both God, the human race, and hopefully the whole beautiful but fragile ecosystem of which we are the stewards. And that brings me to biological evolution. What we have to do here is not be embarrassed by it, but make ourselves the ones who see it most clearly and correctly. We can take a long, careful look, and we do not need to buy into metaphors of selfishness, aggression, and blindness that have been offered by certain vocal commentators. It is true that there is much pain in the natural world, much disease and starvation, but it is also true that there is much harmony, depth, and balanced, rich ecology. I have started to promote a phrase, both in my book and on the blog that I will show you at the end, that I hope might catch on. It's the phrase, the eager gene. Genes are not selfish, and they are not eager either, of course. Meaning, you know, they've no literal moral capacity one way or the other. But the net result of what genes do is better captured by the metaphor of eagerness than that of selfishness. As I say, I'll show you where to find a more complete presentation of that idea at the end. But let's move on now to randomness. Let's think again about randomness in natural processes. Randomness is often portrayed as some sort of defect or problem. But randomness could also be named openness. It is freedom from micromanagement. Is there, in fact, any difference between randomness and openness in cases where there is no conscious agency? But of course, it's far from true that randomness is the dominant principle in evolution. The petals of the rose illustrated here are not random. They show a great deal of structure. This is not primarily because of statistical improbability working on a colossal scale, as Professor Dawkins likes to suggest. In fact, it is mainly because of profound mathematical harmony deep in the nature of the physical world. So let's enjoy and celebrate the fact that biological evolution shows also much signs of improvisation, of making do, of finding new uses for old tools. It is often a story of making something wonderful despite the imperfection of the component parts. This is very much like creativity in human art and artfulness. It is also a law of spiritual life, of how we must learn to live. Here is something of the character of creative love, and so of God. I think people have, in the modern period, begun to misunderstand the word design when it is applied to the natural world. The word design can mean both intention and also detailed prescription. But there is no need to assume that every minute detail of living things was pre-decided by a divine plan. Of course, we have no way of knowing for sure, but the world looks very much as though its originator has allowed it a great deal of freedom to develop in its own way. As far as we can tell, that is the intention, or if you like, design. And this seems to be in keeping with the dance-like quality of the kingdom of God, as Jesus described it, in so many enigmatic hints and pointers. I could go on. I guess others have already begun working at this rethink of the Darwinian process and made more progress than I have. The aim is not to gloss over the pain of the story, nor to see it through rose-tinted spectacles, nor to impose metaphors which it won't bear. The aim is to be true to the story, to see it truthfully, and to help others so to see it. Now, I do want to say a little bit about limits of science. I'm just about at my ending moment, but I've got 5 minutes. Is that all right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Okay. So, yeah, okay. Before I show you my thoughts on a slide, just listen for a moment. So, on the limits of science, by science then, I've sort of taken it that we more or less know what I mean by that. I mean broadly the organised application of empirical test and analytical thought. It's widely felt that this sort of thought is, in the end, the whole of what we need in order to understand our place in the universe. In principle, after all, science is applicable to every physical phenomenon. And that means it is applicable to every last detail of everything we ever experience. What more would we want? What more could anyone add? Before I go on, that's the sort of issue which really bothers people working directly in science. But maybe in the arts and humanities you're not so bothered by that. Can you just show of hands, who's bothered by this sort of issue? And who's thinking, oh, I'm never really worried about that. Okay, bothered? Some. But not a majority. Okay. I get bothered by it. Now, so the thing is that science can, in principle, be applied to every last thing that ever happens. Now, the answer to this is not that science explains a lot, but not everything. No, the answer is that science does not explain anything at all. I will say that again. It is not that science explains a lot, but not everything. Rather, science does not on its own explain anything at all. Instead, science is part of a larger explanation. You can guess where I'm going with this. Science requires all sorts of assumptions about the nature of things, including that reason can be applied, that mathematics has a role to play, and so on and so on. But you might nevertheless feel that I'm just being deliberately bizarre. Surely science explains things, doesn't it? It explains things gloriously. That is what it's all about. And we have mobile phones and vaccination and anesthetics and space probes to prove it. Let's see. So first of all, the continued moment-to-moment existence of the universe is deeply mysterious. The equations that we call laws are descriptive, not prescriptive. They tell us something of the nature of what exists, but they do not tell us how it can exist. Hawking put it very well in his memorable phrase, "It is just a set of rules and equations. What is it that breathes fire into the equations and makes a universe for them to describe?" Well, this point is sort of intriguing, but perhaps not too troubling. But now I'll go to a second point, which is more striking. Think of a description of the Rosetta Stone, for example. Imagine a complete physical description. Suppose it's a description that told you every last detail of that rock, the size and shape of all the markings on it. Such a description is complete in its own terms, but it lacks the most central and crucial insight. It is an apparently complete description, and yet it totally fails. It fails to even grapple with the fact that those markings signify something. Those markings are about beasts and kings and corn, not stones and angular crevices. In a similar way, an analysis of how the universe works can be complete in its own terms, and yet totally inadequate. Once you've had this pointed out, it's easy to see, but it's amazing how often it is ignored in scientific life nowadays. There's this idea that once we've got everything sorted out into algorithmic models and statistical tests, it will all fall into place, we will know who we are. But this really is complete rubbish. I make no apology for using strong language, because it is dangerous rubbish. I'll say more about that in a moment. Science does not explain, but it takes its place as part of a larger explanation. That larger explanation is one that does justice to science, but that also does justice to the mysteries of depth and of purpose. This is not just an abstract issue, it's practical. So I'm going to go a little bit quickly here so there's more time for questions. Here are just a few questions which you could frame, which can't really be framed in scientific terms. What can we learn from Shakespeare's King Lear? Should there be a minimal tariff for murder? And if so, what should it be? Should we pay people for donating blood? And so on and so on. Now the point is, it's easy to find these questions, these sorts of statements, where we know, yeah, it's not so easy to see how science can grapple with that. But it's not so easy to say why science can't grapple with that. Now, what's the problem here? What's that issue? I don't find it easy to tell you why. But I think it's to do with the fact that questions of this type seem to require or imply that you can place some sort of value on human life, at least if you try to tackle them scientifically. And that is, of course, something we just know it's just not the right way of going about it. It is not, simply not possible to say that one person's life is more valuable than another's. We can only do our best to be fair and invite each people to accept voluntarily the unfairness that we cannot avoid. As James Heaney put it in a poem, "It's passive suffering makes the world go round." So, I was ready to say more about this, but I won't. I'm going to get to the end. I'd like to finish by drawing your attention to a blog that I'm writing on in this area of science and religion. That's the website there. And on there, for example, you can see things, that concept that I called eager gene. I wrote about it at slightly greater length. You can also see a post from about a week ago about the presence or absence of goodness or concern in the natural world, and of course plenty of other things. Now, in my talk today, to sum up, I have, among other things, pointed out the dangers of the abuse of science, but I would like to conclude on a positive note. Science is an important and valuable part of the kingdom of God. Indeed, it forms one of the greatest gifts we share. It takes its place in the life of faith as a deep contributor to how we think. Science is not something sitting alongside a rightly conceived and lived faith. Rather, it's part of the way such faith is exercised. Previous generations suffered enormous griefs from bubonic plague, from tuberculosis, from surgery without anaesthetics, from infant mortality. The list goes on and on. It's largely through the gift of science that God has shown us how to find liberty from such oppressions. This liberty was there waiting to be discovered all along. If only ordinary people had laid themselves open to the inspiration and the peaceful and just community living that makes science possible. You can understand why some people see the science itself as the great liberator. But in fact, it is science taking place in an appropriate setting that liberates. Science can also oppress, as it did in Nazi Germany and Stalinist Russia. Ultimately, science is not our master, and it cannot tell us our meaning. We are liberated when we realise this. We are set free both to enjoy the true source of our meaning and to handle science correctly. Thanks for listening so long.
Thanks so much. Plenty of time, I think, for questions. I can come up and sort of field them, or we can just play it by ear.
Yeah, well, let's see what happens.
I have about 1,000 myself, but we'll leave it to the crowd first. So, yeah.
Hi, thanks very much. I'm Alexi, and I'm doing a DPhil in education. And I really find your slide fascinating on biological evolution.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, how do you reconcile your views on biological evolution with biblical doctrine, specifically creation, and for Noah's Ark? I mean, how do you reconcile these real...
Okay, yeah, I'm very happy to talk about that. So just just to say, not to advertise the book, but just genuinely and honestly to be helpful, what I've said today is basically approximately the first half of my book. The second half talks about areas of this kind. So briefly, my own take on that. I consider that I think we all probably believe the following statement, that when we approach the Bible, we ought to be open to the fact that there are many literary genres in the world, and people have written in all sorts of different ways, and that all those ways are equally valuable part of how we can communicate truth to one another. So when we read the first chapters of Genesis, one of the questions we ask ourselves is, so what's the literary genre here? You know, it's a perfectly appropriate question. It's the question one ought to ask in order that we might, as it says in one of the letters of Paul, rightly handle the word of truth. So that genre is, to my mind, clearly largely figurative. And I think that sort of style of something going on which seems a little bit sort of, if I might put it this way, larger than life, or something slightly not quite the same as a more sort of, not quite the same as history of people undergoing sorts of experiences that people undergo ordinarily. that to me lasts right through the first 11 chapters. So it covers, you know, through Noah and the Tower of Babel. There's only room to come to Abraham. It seems to me the genre changes. So that's my first thought. And then on the chapter one, you know, the 7-day narrative, I think that is broadly a sort of an overview of the nature of the physical world. It's sort of saying this is the sort of thing we have. It's a bit like, I think that the writer there is taking the posture somewhat like a literary or cinema critic takes when they sort of give you their take on a piece of work. They sort of draw your attention to the themes and what's going on, and you know who's behind it, what's going on in the piece of work. I think that's the sort of thing I think they're trying to do. And I honestly think that's what they thought they were doing too. Now, I don't know, of course, whether or not people in the ancient Hebrew community thought that can, you know, was literally, you know, was to be taken literally. But I strongly suspect that they did not, at least at first. And it was only later that people took it in that more literal way. Anyway, that's the first chapter. Of course, there's the... since you asked about evolution, I feel that's probably more what you're asking about.
Yeah,
but
you.
I could say more, of course.
That's perfect, and I'll take a look at your work.
Yeah.
My background is in science,
yeah.
And I've met a number of my own peer group over the years and discussed areas of religious phenomena and religious experience.
Yeah.
And Dave said to me, basically, as people not of faith, the things that you're describing, you have to have some sort of, like you said here, evidence-based information behind them. They are... we can't really take them seriously because we can't find the evidence of what you're saying. So the knowing experience or supernatural experience of knowing God and also experiences of the Holy Spirit. So I basically would like to know if there's any sort of secular groups out there, like, I don't know, people that work in psychiatry or psychology that have actually started to seriously look at the area of religious experience and start to study it as a real phenomena and not sort of kind of say, okay, but we know all of this other area in psychiatry and psychology, but this area of religious experience or supernatural experience, we don't take it very seriously or we don't know enough about it. I mean, do those areas of science like psychiatry and psychology really start to study this area and have they started to take it seriously?
Well, you've I think that you've there sort of you've aimed at a couple of different things that both I need to respond to. So one is the idea of religious experience or what I might call mystical experience as well. First of all, when people say that the actual experience itself that people report, you know, that human witness of reporting, that people say, I had this experience. In your question, you put it to us that there are, you know, numbers of people known to you who don't really see that as evidence. So they place almost zero value on that as already evidence.
Mm.
But what are they doing? You know, how can they be so dismissive to billions of people whose lives show reasonable evidence of not being deluded, you know, being... We all know there is the phenomenon of religious madness and all that. But what we're now talking about is part of a very, very widespread part of human life lived out by people living pretty much well, you know, no one's perfect, I think. So, to me, the sort of equating to zero, that's... to me, already highly questionable behaviour to just dismiss that witness. So I use the word witness because it is. It's people witnessing. Now, I found it very helpful to read some thoughts by the Jewish teacher Martin Buber on this.
Okay.
He drew attention to that same idea. There is a sense, according to him, in which you can't really speak of direct evidence for God, but you can speak of people witnessing to God, because it's the more personal aspect of God, which is where the crucial difference lies. Mm. If by that word God, we just mean, oh, shorthand for the sort of abstract principles that impersonally gave rise to the world, then we're sort of, we're talking the language of atheism, and we're just using the word God and attaching it. But if we're not talking that language, we're talking about personal language. And now, what sort of evidence is there for personal things? It's people reporting that they recognise that they have been addressed in personal ways. And that's the only sort of response to a personal reality that there can be. Now, that's the first half. Now, the second half of your question is, though, nevertheless, are people with a somewhat more willing and sort of willing to take seriously sort of point of view, looking into this? Yes, they are. I mean, this is not my field of expertise, but I know there are some perfectly highly qualified, doing good work in psychiatry and psychology, receptive to whether a Christian or other way of looking at the world, who are bringing their study of psychology and psychiatry, with them as part of what they think is really true about our lives. Now, I want to say, though, that that doesn't mean, in my opinion, that you'll sort of put people's psychiatry and psychology sort of under the scientific microscope and thus sort of prove the case from it just won't be like that. Right. You will only, I think, just get further clarity on what people are, how we tick, but you won't, at the end of that journey, sort of find that my point is that there is no journey that can sort of dictate to anyone the choice to think of God in personal language. That is only ever a thing which you can only choose yourself. It can never be dictated to you. So that way of trying to dictate it won't work either. Neither with all the other ways. I know that you don't intend to dictate anything to anyone, but I'm just sort of saying that's the notion that we'll suddenly, at last we'll find it. Oh, here's where we can point to. Now, that's the thought, which I think will vanish. Okay, that won't happen. I think. But let me add another thought, which I find. So, to me, what's the evidence that's so compelling to me? The widespread human witness I already mentioned. But the other evidence for me is largely about the life of Jesus himself. I just think his life is so striking. And how did someone at that time and place just behave that way? What's going on there? It's just extraordinary. And, of course, add to that the resurrection. So, to me, people say there's no evidence. Well, that's evidence, isn't it? And they'll say, yeah, but there is no resurrection. Well, but there is evidence that there was a resurrection. What's the point? There's not nothing. There is evidence. Yeah. So, and that's, for me, an important starting point. Okay. Anyway, that was a rather long answer to it.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah. That's good. Yeah. I'll read up about that
on
the
blog
that you mentioned.
Yeah. Okay, sorry. another question.
Yeah, I think, I think you just answered it, actually.
Okay.
So I'll keep my eyes open. I was going to ask sort of two questions. One was whether or not you're familiar with Alvin Plantinga, the philosopher.
A little, yeah, I've read a little of his work.
Because his idea of faith and faith in like Christian God, for example, is very similar to yours. It's a very similar move, sort of kind of weakening in a way the. A better way to put it, I guess, would be to say that faith is operative kind of everywhere, in our regular knowledge, and so then I guess weakening the standard for justification instead of a high sort of foundationalist standard that one has to meet for justification for belief. It's interesting and it's very similar. But then my question was, I guess, to you is what compels you to choose to believe in the Christian God against other gods other faith systems?
Yeah, okay.
I think you already sort of touched on it.
Yeah, but I guess...
And you think there's more evidence for the Christian God than others?
Yeah, okay. So first of all, you can imagine that... I'll say I am uneasy with that very phrase, the Christian God. That already, that way of speaking is already gone wrong. that's why in my talk I tried, I have used the word God occasionally, but I've also tried to work around it, try to have other ways of speaking, because what the word for me is a shorthand for is the truth of who we're really coming from, of what is the absolute reality. Now, there isn't the Christian God or the something other God, is there? There is just God. And that whole... Now, I know what you mean by that. You're saying, yes, but in the Christian tradition, there are certain ways of perceiving, you know, what we can say of God, and certain traditions about what ways of speaking make sense. So, of course, yeah, I acknowledge that, and that's broadly what you mean.
In the Christian tradition, in the Christian tradition?
Yeah. So, I think what I would say is that I think all of us should be sort of on the lookout for what seems to be really truthful and sense-making in any religious tradition. And it seems to me that the things that are most truthful and sense-making that I've learned of, and the best things that I've learned about, you know, because I'm not an expert in Buddhism or Islam or Hinduism, but I've got some sort of idea of where they're coming from, a little bit, and I feel that I can... I feel that I can sort of see that what I want to buy into does include quite a lot of the sort of things which really matter to Buddhists or to Muslims or Hindus. You know, for example, I mean, this is, if I start to try and say what I mean by that, I'm going to it's risky because I'll say such a small amount about a very rich set of ideas. But just pick an example. Buddhism is very good at helping us understand sort of the limits of our attempts to say we know things. It's very good at insisting that, no, it's not quite how you think, it's other, it's sort of not easy to grasp hold of, it's always outside your grasp. Buddhism is very strong on that, and good at that, and I think that's part of what we need to learn. Of course, in the Hindu way of looking at things, there's a celebration of richness and diversity, isn't there? So I think, again, I can buy into that. Islam is very strong on the sort of reverence for God, the sort of not to treat God's name lightly. I think the Christian world is very guilty of abusing the name of God. You know, just talking about God lightly and not. I don't mean the people who use names as swear words. I don't mean that at all. I mean the ones who just attach the thoughts about God continually to sort of shallow thinking and speaking again and again. So the Islamic world probably looks on that with horror. You know, so the Christian world is guilty of that, I think. Anyway, you see what I'm doing? So that's why, sort of where I'm coming from. So I guess what the journey I feel I'm on is one where at the end of the day, I don't care about, you know, one adjective or another. I do care about what the truth of things really is, but I'm aware that I'm never going to know that for sure. Never going to know that fully. It's a journey. But I do think that those positive things that I learned from other religious traditions seem to me to be there also in what I think Jesus of Nazareth was showing us. So I don't think they have, for me, sort of... I don't see them as a sort of a yes, but... or a, but so much as a, yes, and this is also there. Anyway, I'm being a bit vague now at the end.
That's interesting. If I can follow up.
Okay.
Would you describe those as mostly, I guess, moral reasons for belief or practical reasons for belief? And then how would that sort of interact, like, with the sort of scientific point of view or the theoretical point of view?
Yeah, okay. So, I'm personally...
I'm not trying to shoehorn you into something.
No,
I'm honestly interested because
personally,
it's a philosophical
sort of... The most important thing for me personally, because this is what matters to me, has been, first of all, truthfulness. So, in other words, I don't buy into a way of thinking because I think it'll make me a better person. Although, actually, that's a perfectly good reason to buy into it. But for me, it matters more, is it true or not? And if it's true or not, goodness, I hope it's going to make me a better person. Oh, phew, it does, you know, what a relief. So it's the truthfulness that matters most to me. And that's the starting point. And certainly, I don't think anyone should somehow sell a religious idea because they think it would be good for, you know, good for making people into better people. I can see why you might do that, but I think that isn't probably what you ought to do.
Would it be accurate then to say that this sort of this, the incompleteness of the scientific point of view gives you license to sort of look at these moral beliefs and then, how do I put this rightly? Because of the limits of your knowledge, because you don't know, you know, whether, I guess, Jesus was in fact God, although the evidence seems to suggest that it could, you know, resurrection was, did happen, as you mentioned earlier. Might it be fair to say then that in the face of that, those limits on your knowledge, and the inconclusiveness of the scientific perspective, you're then sort of permitted or justified or something like this, and then sort of looking at these other sort of moral reasons for belief, and then those kind of are, I guess, what kind of fully sort of commit you or kind of draw you into the Christian, it sort of persuade you to be a Christian, or, you know,
I find the style in which you're speaking about it, to me, a little bit too passive, as if I can sort of stand up on side like a great academic and sort of say, oh, yeah, so this, that, and the other, so therefore, I will do God the favour of buying me. So it's that style of thinking I don't like. So I have tried to, obviously today, I have tried to say that I think rationality and our intellectual life is very important. But I think I want to add that in the end of the day, you buy the thing, you buy into, I think, it's a combination of attractiveness of a person and probably other people known to you. So it's other people in the present now that you've read of a little bit through history, and then you've read one particular person. So it's the attractiveness that you see there. Combine, I think, also for me, with a sense of your own, the fact that you are actually genuinely in difficulty about becoming the person you would rather be. You know, that's, you know, I'm talking now about the, in the traditional language, what would be called the consciousness of sin. But that whole language is sort of a little bit misunderstood nowadays. So I'm just talking about a frank and realistic assessment of your own condition, and with it, the realization that it's not only is your own condition not quite as you would like it to be, nor can you make it how you'd like it to be. So you are a bit stuck. So that really sort of counts. So you've got the stuckness, the attraction. You think, oh goodness, there's something on offer here that might be the thing that will crack this open for me. So you give it a try and think, oh goodness, it seems to be you're in a new place. Anyway, that's sort of more like it.
I think it's kind of the power of God in our lives that often sort of makes the difference.
Exactly.
It's like that's where you kind of bite the bullet. So
yes.
This is what I need. This is why. It's because of grace and God's activity.
That's right. So I say, I repeat, good. I'm glad you're with me there. And I repeat, I do not want to in any at all downgrade this sort of the importance of the intellectual side of it. But I do also remember that phrase of Paul in one of his letters, that it's not just words but the power, you know. And he means by not power over other people and a horrible power. He means, you know, power to change.
Forgive me for my detachment.
No, that's fine.
Another question. This is just a really broad one. But do you think the existence of God is a scientific question?
As soon as you say, is there a question about the existence of God, you're asking the wrong question. The question is only, what is the nature of God? And you see, God is the word we use to describe that which is, whether we like it or not, from whom, I use that word whom, okay, from where we have come, that is the bottom line of what the universe, of what is the creative, background to, source of, at work in, universe, okay. So the question is not, does that exist? That exists by definition. The question is, how can I come to know that? Can I come to know that purely by the analytical approach, the one in which we lay out things before us that we can passively assess and thus learn? Is that the only way of learning? Or is there also the other way, which we exercise all the time, talking about another, of course, you know, I just see you there, I don't first work out who you are, I start talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that other way of dealing with the reality that exists,
mm-hmm.
also a valid way of dealing with the reality that exists.
Right.
See, the question is not, does the reality exist? It's,
yeah.
how do you engage with that reality? What ways of engaging are appropriate?
How would you know?
Yeah, so how, you know, is the stance that is willing to open up your heart a little bit to the thought, not just I it, but I thou, I'm using that phrase of Martin Buber there, is that stance, that attitude that humans might choose to adopt, is it a valid attitude?
Right.
So that's the question.
Right.
And you'll never answer it passively.
Right.
I mean, you can see that, yeah, it might be a valid attitude, and then you'll only answer it for yourself by trying it.
It does seem to me, if the Christian scheme is correct, then God wouldn't be, you wouldn't be able to put him in a test tube anyway, so you would never be able to make that case, I think, that God should simply submit to, he should be small enough that our scientific, you know, process or method could determine whether he exists or not, and then proceed from there. He would just be kind of, in a sense, transcend that.
Okay, so you're using the sort of language which, I agree, a lot of people have pushed you into that language. It's not the language that Jesus adopted or he recommended
right.
we adopt. He didn't try to prove points about the existence of God. He just said, you know what, the reality from whom you really come from absolutely is like this. You know, it's sort of like getting to know what it's all about. It's a bit like finding some treasure in a field, and that treasure's worth everything you ever had. You know, he doesn't say exactly what he means.
Yeah.
He's sort of saying, change the way you think about life. Think of it like this. Think of it like a parent.
Then how do you then convince, like, so Lawrence Krauss, is he a physicist or a astronomer or something?
I believe
cosmologist,
yeah.
whatever. He would say that God, that is acceptable. Well, maybe it's Richard Dawkins or maybe it's both of them, but
okay.
one of them or both of them says that is a scientific question. If God, you know, if he's part of reality, then that should ultimately be something.
That's right. Okay,
question.
I know where you are now. Okay,
so
but this
yeah.
issue is more difficult. This is David Hume and Dawkins' point about, you know, that if God were real, that he would not be simple, but, you know, simple explanation, blah, blah, you know what I mean? Okay. So, for everyone, in case you're not sure what we're talking about. So this is the puzzle that, again, is not easy to unravel about the idea of how can we say that the world comes from a source that has, as I would claim, personal characteristics, you know, with whom one can relate in a sort of personal sort of a way. See, I hold back from saying who is a person, because that, again, you can say that, and it's not completely wrong, but it tends to slightly begin to sort of pigeonhole God in a slightly another way. But perhaps to whom one can relate in personal ways, you know, from whom one might feel there is the possibility of mercy coming, and to whom it might be appropriate to offer some sort of sense of, I would like to do this for you. You know, is that way of thinking valid? Okay, so what Krauss and Hume and others have said, well, is that, well, come on, that can't make sense, because it's sort of saying that beyond the physical world of sight and sense and touch, there's this other reality that is a whole heap more complex than anything we can possibly imagine, and you know, it just doesn't sort of fit with the whole way of making sense of the world that science has taught us. Okay, so the answer to that, I believe, is to take seriously the thought which I have alluded to today, that it genuinely is very difficult, with very much difficulty, that we can try to embrace God in language. So I said earlier, do you remember I said something about that what we are doing when we meet on a Sunday, on a privacy of our own room, is not talking about the supernatural super entity, the greatest entity in the class of all entities. See, philosophically speaking, that's already compartmentalized God into a category called entity, which can be sort of looked at and stood away from. And that's the only way of thinking that someone like Lawrence Krauss or Richard Dawkins is allowing.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as they restrict to that way of thinking, they're right. Yeah, you'll never get God that way. it will never make sense. That way of thinking about God will never make sense.
Right.
But what they conclude is, therefore, thinking about God does not make sense. Mm-hmm. But what they miss is, but there are other ways of thinking than the ways that say everything is just an entity.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So I'm now being a little bit subtle philosophically, right? This is not for the light-hearted sort of thing. I think what it is, what I mean is that those to whom God has given the gift to really think things through at this sort of philosophical level ought to do so, and ought to try to say things like this and say them as clearly as they can. But that doesn't immediately mean that we've somehow made the religious sort of ways of living faithfully sort of only available to an intellectual few. It doesn't mean that at all, because the ones to whom God has not given that particular gift can still just immediately embrace the reality of God in their life and in their experience, as many do, of course. And that's perfectly valid. You know, of course, what the test is, you know, did we visit the prisoner and give water to the one who was thirsty? And that, not did we have the right category in our abstract thought. So I mean,
yeah. Sure, Jordan. Yeah.
I'll ask two, and you can answer one or the other or both. The first one is: would you say that you're at least somewhat sympathetic, if not intellectually, but maybe perhaps at least in spirit, with an apophatic theology?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's easy. I'll ask the next one.
Explain apophatic.
It's not the whole truth, but it's an important part of the truth, in my opinion. Go ahead. Say what that is for everyone.
All I mean by it is just a theology that is largely takes the approach of describing the nature of God by what God is not. And it recognises the limits of language and our ability to understand.
Yeah, I just did a bit just now, didn't I? What I was saying there about not that. That was apophatic theology, for example. Yeah, go on.
The other one is perhaps technical and better save for later, but I'll ask it anyway. As someone who works in quantum mechanics, you must have thought at least quite deeply on the sort of the theological implications or a theological understanding of quantum. It's so abstract. You have a spinning state vector, and it has all these different bases, all these weird things, and we can't say. We can't test it. We don't know if there's such a thing, but we know it works mathematically.
Yeah.
We can test the outcomes of things, but we can't see if there's such a thing as a state vector. And we have just probabilities or frequencies, depending on your philosophy, or something else. Do you have any thoughts, I guess, that are sort of related to the philosophy of quantum mechanics, or is that important in your thinking?
Yeah, I guess what I say to that is that you've touched on a couple of different issues. On the one hand, you've got the straight science, straight philosophy question concerning what do we make of what quantum mechanics is telling us about the nature of the physical world. So straight, just within the territory of science and philosophy, you know, what is that saying? And yeah, I think that's important to try to settle that. It's not settled yet. For those of you who are not aware of this, so quantum physics has been around now for 80 years, but right at its foundations, it's still a puzzle about what it really means and how is the right way to say in words what it's telling us about the nature of, you know, this desk or, you know, this table, the air in the room. You know, at the level of the underlying waves and particles and what they really are, we can't really say what they are. You know, we do have, as you say, lots of mathematical equations which sort of connect one thing to another, and I think that's a good. It's a valid question to ask about what we really are finding out there, and it's as yet unanswered, and it will continue. And I have contributed, you know, in a modest way to that. But I think more interestingly, I'd like to add two thoughts. One is, if we learn, what's the most important single thing I think quantum mechanics has to offer to the thoughts about the nature of the world and the nature of God? Well, it's the remarkable deep beauty that there is, extraordinarily woven in to the world at its basic level. It's just a fantastically beautiful and elegant fundamental workings of the world, for all that there's horrible, ugly pain and things going on as well. In this aspect, at least, there's something remarkably beautiful going on. That's a really startling. So that's one thing it offers. And then the other thing it offers is, interestingly, this connects to your puzzle you raised first. So quantum mechanics throws up physical concepts, among them a concept called entanglement, which I won't try to describe, partly because you've got to spend about 3 years learning quantum physics to try to understand what this thing is. Right? But what I can tell you about it is that it shows us that it is in fact the case that there can be real things whose nature is of such a strange quality that before this area of physics came along, became well established, how do you try to describe what we are talking about? We talk about entanglement to someone 100 years ago. They would have said, probably, you know, Andrew, with the best will in the world, I think it just sounds like you're talking nonsense. And the point I'm making is that that's what people have accused theologians of talking. And sometimes they have talked nonsense. But they've also talked a great deal of careful sense about what people really actually do experience about reality. And I'm talking here primarily about the concept called Trinity. So that is not a nonsense concept. It was always understood to be a concept somewhat beyond our full grasp, but that a valid way of bringing together what is a genuine about the experience that we have. So to me, that's a fantastic piece of theology that stood the test of time. It's still very profoundly helpful to people today. Puzzling, of course. So one thing I get from quantum physics is perhaps a little bit more humility, intellectual humility. And that's a great gift, of course. Would everyone could have that lovely gift. Yeah.
Other questions? Carl, you... Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've heard this argument before, but I'd be interested to hear if you have. Muslims that I speak to talk about the idea of no transcendence of Allah, and that you cannot, that he cannot really know human nature. He doesn't transcend down to our level. There's no such thing as even an intellectual knowing of God or God knowing us, and this idea of relationship to God. And their argument is, well, the ones that I've spoken to over the years, is that they're more aligned, their thinking and their theology is more aligned to the area of scientific critique and scrutiny than the Christians, because the Christians seem to try to give answers to all of this, whereas, you know, Islam tries to distance itself from that.
Yeah.
And so therefore, in the area of science and reason, Islamic theology is more progressive.
Well, okay.
I don't know if you've actually heard that argument from...
I haven't heard that particular argument. Yeah. I'd say this is not an area that I speak from any... expertise at all, right? So I don't really know anything more about this than anyone else in the room, probably. I would say, though, that part of what one would want to include in a discussion of that kind is the history, is intellectual history generally overall in the last, you know, 1,000 years.
Yeah.
So the Islamic world made a, you know, a very great contribution to the intellectual study in its, in what is now called its golden age. You know, pioneered maths and science and so on. But broadly speaking, it hasn't shown the sort of intellectual energy and creativity that one might have hoped for from that, cause from that strong beginning.
Mm.
Now, this is quite a, you know, I have to tread carefully here, because I don't want to say something untruthful or unfair, but that is how it looks to me. But I admit, I'm not a historian, and I'm not the first one to point this out, of course. And I don't have the right to sort of elaborate on it, because, you know, I probably end up saying something unfair. But that is part of what I would want to include in the discussion along the lines you said. Because coming back to something I do know a bit about, the broadly Christian culture that, I mean, you know, that no culture has ever been thoroughly Christian, has it? You know, it's claimed to be, but it wasn't really. But, that, you know, nevertheless had a lot of Christian influence. So that broadly Christian culture that, that grew up in large parts of Europe was very productive scientifically. So there, at least I can be very positive about it. So if someone is saying, oh, the Christian way of looking at things somehow doesn't really lead to scientific creativity and productivity, yeah, well, that's wrong, and it's historically wrong. Mm-hmm. So there I can be a little bit more positive in my assertion.
Mm-hmm. We're getting close to the end of our time, but are there any other questions at all? Nothing? Well, we have more wine, I think, and more opportunity probably to discuss things one-on-one, if that's more comfortable. Yeah. And let's Jordan, you do have another. Okay, I'll bring that up after we thank Professor Steen one more time for a great talk. And then, thank you.